Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, I'm Nicholas Gordon, host of the Asian Review of Books podcast, done in collaboration with the New Books Network. In this podcast, we interview fiction and nonfiction authors working in, around, and about the Asia-Pacific region. Chang'anjie, or Long Peace Street, stretches across central Beijing. Along it are several important historical sites, such as Zhongnanhai, Tiananmen Square, and the Forbidden City, all important to Beijing's history as the center of Imperial, Republican, and then Communist China. Jonathan Chatwin, in his book Long Peace Street, A Walk in Modern China, recently published in paperback, uses Long Peace Street as a way to present the modern history of Beijing and China. Starting at the road's beginning at the former Capital Iron and Steelworks, Chatwin takes the reader on a journey along Long Peace Street and through China's political history, as it changes from a declining empire to a fast-growing and increasingly confident communist state. Jonathan Chatwin is a travel writer and journalist. His essays and articles have been published by the South China Morning Post, the British Film Institute, the LA Review of Books, among other publications. He is also the author of Anywhere Out of the World, The Work of Bruce Chatwin, published in 2012, as well as the host of the Southern Tour podcast, which examines China's reform and opening through the prism of Deng Xiaoping's legendary Southern Tour of 1992. In this interview, I'll ask Jonathan to chart this journey along Long Peace Street for us, talking about both the major sites we may have seen on our own journeys to Beijing and some of the less well-known yet equally interesting points along this road. We'll talk about some of his own personal experience of writing the book and Beijing's relationship to its past. So, Jonathan, thank you so much for joining me today. Perhaps it's best to start with the star of the book, Long Peace Street. What is this road, and where does it start? Where does it end? How long is it? You know, can you tell us a bit more about this road?
Sure. So the question of sort of where it begins and ends is, as with Beijing itself, a little bit difficult to define. Chang'anjie is a relatively modern imposition. Those of you who've been to Beijing will probably know that many of the imperial sites were laid out along a north-south axis that runs through the city, as was common with many Chinese cities. That was the traditional way of orienting your city architecture. When the CCP took over in 1949, they, for a number of different reasons, end up joining together some of the parallel west-east lines that run across the city, including Chang'anjie, which at the time that the CCP took over was still a relatively, relatively short in the sense that it didn't extend very far beyond the original city walls. And the CCP start to revise Beijing, partly in the model of Moscow. They were being advised by the Soviets. And they turn Chang'anjie into a very wide street that runs through the center of the city in between Tiananmen Square and the Forbidden City, partly because in 1959 they want to parade their troops along it to celebrate the 10th anniversary of their rule. So it becomes a kind of symbol of the architectural revision of Beijing, the idea of the communists declaring this as their capital. And as you mentioned in the intro, it's the site of a number of very significant buildings, both from the imperial era, but perhaps more pertinently now, from the communist era. As the years have gone on and Beijing has spread, it's got longer and longer. And now I start my walk, as you mentioned, at the old Beijing, the Capital Iron and Steel Works, which is no longer really there. It's now the site of the 2022 Winter Olympics is the headquarters for that. And they've extended Chang'anjie out across the river to the west, and to the east it kind of ends up turning into a bit of a highway, which then drifts down to Tianjin. So again, sort of metaphoric of the city's spread, Chang'anjie just gets longer and longer. And it's probably worth saying that the title of the book, Long Peace Street, is a very literal interpretation of the name. It's generally translated as the Avenue of Eternal Peace. But for a number of reasons, one of which was that I wanted to give the sense of this being a long walk, I chose the perhaps more direct and pithy title of Long Peace Street.
So I guess actually how walkable is this street? Is it possible or maybe even advisable for someone to walk the same path that you did throughout the book?
I think one of the interesting things about doing the walk was me reflecting on methods of transport in Beijing, and walking has long been, you know, back to the imperial days, not a very popular method of getting around the city, partly because in the sort of imperial days, the city streets were famed for their dust, and when it rained, for their mud and the kind of rutted tracks that went along them. I have always found walking cities to be an excellent way of getting to understand them. I lived in Beijing and greatly enjoyed walking around it. And I think it is still at its center, certainly the older parts of the city where the old alleyways or hutong exist. It's a city that rewards, in my opinion, walking. And I was partly inspired by something Simone de Beauvoir talked about in her book when she visited in 1955, a book called The Long March, where she talks about walking a city kind of giving this immediate, irrecusable experience that really helps you to get to grips with a place. I would say that Chang'anxie as a way of walking Beijing is not, it wouldn't be my first recommendation for visitors to the city for a number of reasons. I think, as I said, it's symbolic of this revision of the city that happened under CCP rule, particularly in the first decade of the 1950s. It's very long and straight and broad, and a lot of the architecture along it now, which, you know, more recent architecture, is kind of bland. Some of it perhaps, you know, associated with the movement of, listeners might be familiar with this idea of Western star architects coming in, you know, big Western architectural firms coming in and building showcase buildings. But a lot of it's 19 miles that I walked of it. Long stretches of it are through bits of Beijing that don't appear on many tourist maps, put it that way. So for me, I mean, there was a kind of appeal to that because it was a little bit more interesting than perhaps and less well known perhaps than some of the sites on the north-south axis, like the Drummond Bell Tower, the Temple of Heaven, places like that. But it wouldn't be, as I say, it wouldn't be my recommendation of the first place to visit. The other reason I just quickly say is, I walked in August, which is a terrible time of year to do anything outside in Beijing. People, you know, I met people along the way and they would ask, you know, got into conversations, and everybody that I met, all the Beijingers I met and told them what I was doing, just looked at me like I'd gone completely mad. And it's true that if you are going to walk it, that you've got to pick your season more carefully than I did.
Yeah, I definitely know the trials and tribulations of trying to walk a city in the middle of summer. there was a lot in that answer, and I'm going to pick at a few specific points. The first is you kind of talked about how the city was kind of I'm probably paraphrasing, but kind of remade when the CCP took over. It's worth kind of taking a big picture of view here and asking, well, first of all, like, has Beijing always played the central role in modern Chinese history? And when do we start to see, when do we start to see a shift of political, economic, cultural importance to Beijing?
Sure. I mean, Beijing, the name of Beijing means Northern Capital. And it is it's an accident of history. I suppose you could say that about every capital city to some extent, but Beijing is an unusual choice as a capital. It doesn't have a major river or port. It's actually, they have had for a long time problems with water supply in Beijing. It sits on a pretty arid plain. It's quite far distant from the traditional economic and cultural heartland of China. So particularly the area, we can call Jiangnan, south of the Yangtze, which was really, for a long period of time, you know, the economic, you know, and cultural driver of Chinese culture. So it's an unusual choice. It ends up there really because the nomads from the north establish it finally in 1279 as a national capital. And then it looks like it's going to go back when the Ming take over. It looks like he's going to go back to Nanjing, which is the name of Nanjing, means southern capital. And, you know, the capital is reestablished there and a palace is built. And then the man who will become known as the Yongle Emperor wrests control back and then restores Beijing as the national capital. And it's been located there with a brief interruption during the nationalist era in the 20th century ever since. And I think it's, you know, not only was it an odd choice, perhaps originally, you know, a geographical anomaly in some ways, having a capital so far north of the cultural and economic heartland of the country. But when the communists took over in 1949, again, it seems an unlikely choice for them. You know, the CCP have been all about overthrowing the feudal rule of past centuries. And of course, you know, Beijing in its physical form, it is an imperial city. It represents that old order in the way that it is constructed and built and the way that it is walled off. I mean, you know, the imperial city was, which sat at the center of Beijing, was, you know, protected space. So in a way, it's a surprising choice for them. And as I say, then they get, for the first decade in particular, get on with refashioning under the, with advice from these thousands of Soviet advisors who are in China at the time. They get on with refashioning Beijing into some sort of version of a socialist capital and tear down, as listeners will probably know, tear down a lot of the imperial architecture that existed.
So the centerpiece of Longpeace Street, I mean, both the street itself, but also your book, is Tiananmen Square and the Forbidden City. Do you see, I guess, both of these sites, you know, both the square and the Forbidden City, having the same centrality in Beijing's and even China's history?
I think if you, to start with Tiananmen Square, what's quite interesting about that space is that the juxtaposition of what the square represents with what the Forbidden City, which is just across the 10 lanes of Longpeace Street to the north, represent. It's quite an acute juxtaposition. And I mean, Beijing and China generally is sort of full of these interesting juxtapositions. But Tiananmen Square was, until communist years, not a square. It was a sort of T-shaped, well, it had a gate in the middle and a kind of corridor going through ministries and sort of government functions either side. And you know, partly, as I say, inspired by the urban plan of Moscow in the 1950s, Tiananmen Square is turned into this kind of symbolic heart to the city. I always find it an interesting comparison to the city squares of Europe, for example, the idea of the piazza with commerce and trade. And of course, listeners who've been to Beijing will know that is not what Tiananmen Square is. It was built as a kind of with a ceremonial function in mind, which is partly to do with the parades that happen now every decade along it. It's quite, it was at one time the biggest public square in the world, although there's I think in Dalian now has that honour. It has Mao's mausoleum at the centre of it, sitting on that north to south axis that I mentioned. And that north to south axis was traditionally associated with the imperial map of Beijing. So citing Mao's mausoleum and his body bang on that line, you know, is symbolically significant. I think it's a place that, perhaps we'll talk about the protests the square gives its name to. It's a place that for visitors to Beijing is often the first, you know, number one on the itinerary. And I always find it, you know, an interesting experience talking to people who've just gone to Tiananmen for the first time, because it's not a particularly, you know, it's difficult to access. It's one of the most heavily policed public spaces in the world. Now you have to pass through a number of checkpoints to get onto it. And then when you're there, you know, it's sort of, what are you doing there? There's nothing, you know, you can have a look at some of the monumental architecture that surrounds it, the socialist realist architecture of the 1950s. But it's, as I say, sits in contrast to what we often think of a city public square as being. So it's an odd space, I think, and it's become all the more curious, as you know, in recent decades. It's a site of incredible nervousness for the Chinese Communist Party, and you sense that when you're there.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
I think we'll return to a discussion of the protests, I think, later on in this interview. Because right now, I think I want to talk about, you can see potentially three kind of broad phases of modern Chinese history. You have the imperial era right before the revolution. So things like the Boxer Rebellion, things like that. Then you have the post-revolution Republican period, the presidency of Yuan Shikai, and so on. And then, of course, you have the communist era after 1949. How do you see each of these eras reflected in Long Peace Street?
I think in terms of the imperial era, what's interesting about Long Peace Street is that it is a subversion of the imperial, and a very deliberate subversion of the imperial plan for a city, which is set out in the second century BCE, which talks about the north-south axis having kind of preeminence in a Chinese city. So to build the main thoroughfare of the city on that east-west axis is a deliberate act of contradiction in a way. And of course, what happens as they build it and extend it is they dismantle more and more of the imperial architecture that sits along it. So, for example, at the center of where Tiananmen Square now is, and the road sits between that and the Forbidden City, there used to be a number of gates that have been torn down, for example. Obviously, later on, the city walls disappear to build Beijing's first subway line, underground line. So the story the street tells of the imperial area is actually to some extent one of destruction, because a lot of what you will get to places like Jianguomen, for example, which is the name of a gate originally punched through slightly more recently by the Japanese, but one of the old gates in the old city wall is not there anymore, because the second ring road is there instead. But there's a sort of these architectural echoes as you walk down it of things that used to exist. There are some other markers of the imperial history. So Diaoyutai, which is a kind of state guest house now, was co-opted by the CCP, but that has imperial origins. And obviously you mentioned Zhongnanhai, which is the sort of party headquarters, equivalent to sort of the White House, I suppose, is a comparison people might understand. And that was, again, part of the imperial city, and has a long imperial history before the CCP take it over as their headquarters. So there are things that still are extant on the road, but a lot of it, you know, a lot of the time I spent walking along it, there was a reflection of, and I think that's the theme of the book, what has been lost and destroyed in that era. In terms of the post imperial era, so the Republican bit of Chinese history, that kind of brief period, there's some interesting, you know, little known bits of history from that. You know, I like to share when I do talks about the book the photo of Tiananmen Gate with a picture of Chiang Kai-shek, a portrait of him hanging from the gate where Mao Zedong now has his portrait. But prior to that, Yuan Shikai, who takes control, you know, just after the end of the imperial era, he actually bases himself in Zhongnanhai. So he's the sort of person who establishes that as a center of political control in the post-imperial years. And Chang'anjie begins to change under the Republican, in the Republican era. So trams are installed, for example, along it. And there are sort of tentative steps taken to modernize the city. In terms of then the communist era, I think the most important thing to say about that is that Chang'anjie was seen as a showcase for the socialist realist architecture of the 1950s, and in particular, some of what are called Beijing's 10 great buildings. So these were big architectural projects that the CCP undertook running up to the 1959 10-year anniversary of their rule. Examples would be the military museum, which sits on Chang'anjie, the railway station just to the east of Tiananmen Square, the museum, what is now the National Museum on the east side of the square, the Great Hall of the People on the western side. These were all big landmark projects designed to, as I say, sort of symbolize Beijing's new life as this socialist capital. And Chang'anjie was seen as a showcase for these big buildings. So those are probably the most obvious markers of this.
What are some, let's say, lesser known sites you'd like to highlight from your book, you know, whether as things to see or historical markers or just something that you think is just plain interesting?
Sure. I mean, I think I perhaps haven't done a terribly good job of selling Chang'anjie as a destination for visitors to Beijing. And I think some of the most interesting bits of it are slightly more hidden away, perhaps some of the side streets. If you come down the eastern side of Tiananmen, for example, you can walk through what's left of Beijing's old legation quarter. So this is the sort of area where foreigners and particularly diplomats were confined, and some very interesting, you know, some of it has been, unfortunately, or a lot of it has been destroyed, but there are still little architectural reminders of some of those years. And, you know, the diplomatic residences and compounds were often built as kind of echoes of European or home styles of architecture. So you get a really nice kind of mix of different Western styles. And as I say, there is still enough left there that you can get a sense of that. The other place that I often recommend to people that's worth visiting, which sits right on Chang'anjie, is the old Imperial Observatory, which is on the eastern wing of the street. And next to that old part of the city wall, I mentioned the gate, Yangguoman. And you know, a lot of people, it's very easy to kind of miss because it's only relatively small. And it's a site where it was built in the southeastern reaches of the old Tartar city, the old inner city of Beijing, and has a very long history. What's interesting to me is that so it, you know, it goes back to the 13th century. That site does. There's a site nearby just to the north of it where it was originally. But so very long history. But if you go and look at the observatory instruments that are there, they're actually designed by a Flemish Jesuit missionary called Ferdinand Verbies, who in 1673 is commissioned by the emperor to kind of renovate and redesign and make more accurate instruments for this observatory. And then those instruments, when the Boxer Rebellion happens at the beginning of the 20th century, they get taken off to Germany and France by the troops that come to rescue the foreigners who are held under siege in the legation quarter. So there's quite a storied history there to, which tells a little bit about some of the interaction between the West and the East that happened perhaps earlier than we often think about in the West. It's also quite an evocative space because it's one of the last bits of the wall. It sits up on an old fragment of the wall. So it's well worth, popping in and seeing it. And it gives, it's one of the few places you get a bit of a view as well. Beijing famously flat, and walking along Tang'anjie, it's sometimes hard to get your bearings. The observatory is a useful stopping point from that respect as well.
So I think one more question about the history. The most recent event you discuss in your book, beyond things that happened a few years ago, is the Tiananmen Square protests and the crackdown that followed. I wonder if you could just share a few thoughts about how you see those protests and their place in understanding kind of China's modern history and its modern development.
Yeah, it's an interesting question because it was one of the parts of the book I think I found hardest to write, partly because it's something that it was one of the few things I was touching on that I knew general readers would already have knowledge of. It was something that it was an inevitable part of the story, not just because Tiananmen is at the center of the street and the center of the book, but actually, although the protests are known by the name of the square, a lot of the conflict went on actually on the western and eastern reaches of Tang'anjie. That was a, you know, that was always going to be, you know, places like Musidi out to the west, which was the site of a kind of pitched battle. That was always going to be something that the street threw up as an historical resonance. I think that what I tried to do to some extent was contextualize the 1989 protests with a little bit of the history of the kind of couple of decades before, and talk about Tiananmen itself and Tang'anjie generally as a site of political protest, because, you know, Tiananmen in the old days before it was the communist square. So May 4th, 1919, it's a site of protest. You've got Xidan down out to the west on Tang'anjie, which in 1978 is the site of the Democracy Wall movement. A couple of years before that, in April of 1976, there are protests there after the death of Zhou Enlai. And Zhongnanhai itself, the gate there, which leads into the party compound, has been a place where people have come to petition and protest as well. So I think one of the downsides of focusing solely on the 1989 protests is that, I think there's two things. First of all, I think that often the national scale of those protests is overlooked. So the fact that it wasn't just Beijing where those protests were happening, they were happening in many, many cities all over China. But also this idea that there were other precursor protests to it in the 80s as well, and obviously going back to the 70s. So I tried to contextualize a little bit just to broaden perhaps people's understanding of that movement. But it's obviously a hugely significant moment in China's political and social history. It's never an easy subject to write about, I think, for lots of different reasons. But I tried to give it the space it deserved, but also, as I say, kind of give it a sense of historical context at the same time.
So how did you decide to blend your own personal experiences with Beijing with your discussion of Chinese history? The chapter that comes to mind is the chapter on the Revolutionary Secretary. The Revolutionary Cemetery. And how you blended your own visit to the cemetery with the history that's wrapped up in that site. So I guess as you were planning and writing the book, how did you decide to blend your personal experiences with the historical narrative?
Yeah, I think, you know, obviously we've talked a lot about the history that is involved in the street and Beijing today, but I think it is something that I really wanted the book to do was to capture the sense of being in the physical space of the city. I did the walk in 2016, and I really wanted it. You know, my background is academically studying travel writing, and I'm a big believer in the power that travel writing has to help people understand and experience places that they might not otherwise visit. So to me, it was really important that it captured a sense of that physicality of moving through the city. And I spent a long time trying to think about how to do that. The reason I picked Changantie, well, there are a number of reasons. Obviously, it's hugely historically resonant, as we've established, but it's also manageable in a way that, you know, I traveled and I still, well, until last year struck, I travel a lot in China. And it is, you know, it's a truism and it's a cliche to say, you know, how big it is, you know. And as a Western writer writing about a place that is not, you know, my own, I'm very conscious of not overstating my kind of knowledge and insight into a place. So it seemed to me a manageable slice of the city. I lived in Beijing, so I knew the city already pretty well. And I think it ends up being a bit of an odd hybrid, the book, in that sense that it is a kind of melding of history and personal experience. But I hope that through that, it gives obviously a kind of foundational insight into, you know, the history of Beijing is the history of China, certainly for the last several centuries. So hopefully it gives some insight into that. But also, I just think that experience of being on the ground, walking through urban space in China is something that I never tire of. It's still the way that I explore cities that I, or places I haven't been to. I try and spend as much of my time on foot as I can. And so I wanted that sense of the sensory experience to be, you know, a preeminent part of the book. So I worked quite hard to try and integrate, to try and balance the two, but it was quite a challenge, I think.
So I'm gonna quote a line from your book, from near the end of the book, where you write, "Modern Beijing is a mess, a glorious mess. Noisy, endlessly sprawling, confounding to navigate, and echoing with the muffled shouts of those who chafed against its impositions, physical, spiritual, political. Rather than hearing those voices, the city seemed instead to rouse itself now only for the promise of more change. Change without considered thought, without anything but a call to action. A picking up of hammers and pickaxes and drills, and another new building, another new road, another lost hutong, another created layer of concrete and steel ringing around it." So Beijing's not alone in this. I mean, lots of major cities have a sometimes strained, sometimes distant relationship with their history. I know we in Hong Kong had this discussion a lot. But I guess, how do you see Beijing now as the capital city of an increasingly confident China, of a very more economically developed, a richer China? How do you see Beijing's relationship with its history, as expressed in physical sites like the ones you talk about in your book? How do you see that relationship changing or developing?
I think it's a very good question. I am always acutely aware of the danger of lapsing into a kind of Western nostalgic perspective on old Beijing, and the reality of much of the housing. So when the communists take charge in 1949, Beijing was in a pretty dilapidated state. A lot of houses didn't have any running water. Electricity was patchy. And you know, even in more recent years, many of the hutong and the sehoyuan, the courtyard houses along them, were not the kind of glorious courtyard houses of imperial history. They had become, they're often referred to as dazaiyuan, these kind of big, messy courtyards occupied by multiple families very often. So there is an obvious need for regeneration in any city. And part of that, I guess, inevitably involves destruction and refashioning. I think the problem with Beijing, as I allude to in that extract, is that there has very rarely been a coherent plan. Coherent in the sense of kind of well well thought through for the long term, I think, in terms of what they want Beijing to look like and be like. The Hutong, which, you know, numbered in, you know, several thousand when the communists took over the city, have now dwindled into, you know, a few hundred. They are being, in recent years, the process of destruction has stopped and they have started to be kind of they talk about them being bricked up, where these small shops and restaurants that existed along them have been closed, and the way they look from the outside has been restored to some sort of Fo Qing dynasty version of themselves. So in a way, although I have, you know, there is still issues around that, that's a better solution than destroying them. But the thing that I find, you know, thinking about Beijing's recent past, hard to reconcile, is the fact that there were aspects of the city that could have been preserved, particularly the walls, I think, which, you know, other Chinese cities, Xi'an perhaps most well known, did manage to incorporate and still have traffic flowing through them, for example. And there's a quite a famous plan put forward by the Chinese architect Liang Zicheng, where he envisaged the walls becoming public spaces with kind of tea houses and gardens along them. And it's hard not to kind of look at what they built in the end instead, which was the second ring road, which is this enormous sort of motorway that runs around the city. It's hard not to look at that and think, what a shame that wasn't how Beijing ended up. I think the challenge now for them, it's an interesting phase to look at Beijing as a global city. They have imposed a population cap on the capital, as they have on Shanghai as well. They are trying to ship out, the government are, some of what they call the non-capital functions. These are things like education, healthcare, to other parts of the nearby satellite cities. And they're building a brand new city to the southwest called Xiongan, which will be connected via high-speed rail to the capital. So there is a sort of feeling at the moment that that's the plan that they have settled on. The restoration of the old bits, very much in keeping with Xi Jinping's kind of vision of a kind of glorious past. So I think that's something that has changed. And you see it in the Forbidden City too, where a lot more effort being put into presenting a version of China's glorious past before the so-called century of humiliation, which begins in the middle of the 19th century. So that, you know, in terms of the historical architecture, that seems to be the direction they're traveling in. Obviously, to the east, they've built this big modern city with skyscrapers and shopping malls and all that sort of thing. And then, yeah, you've got these satellites sitting out one to the east and one to the southwest, which are going to alleviate some of the stress and strain on the city. So it'll be fascinating. I mean, I wrote the book. I did the walk in 2016 and wrote it in the subsequent years. And there's always a new story to be told about urban China. I'm working a lot on the Pearl River Delta area, and there's always a new government idea, a new initiative. And it's a fascinating thing to watch. But yes, you hope that period of destruction, kind of willful and to some extent mindless destruction, has at least paused for the moment.
So with that, thank you for listening to our interview with Jonathan Chatwin, author of Long Peace Street, A Walk in Modern China. Jonathan, one actual final question. What's next for you, and where can people find your work?
So the book is literally, we're talking on the 6th of April, and the book is coming out today in paperback. And it's available, I think, everywhere today in paperback. I'm currently working on, you mentioned I host a podcast about Deng Xiaoping's Southern Tour. So I'm currently trying to write a book about that journey that he made. I retraced that journey in the summer of 2019. You mentioned 89 as this sort of pivotal moment, and Deng Xiaoping's Southern Tour of 1992 comes a few years after that, and is kind of a reopening of China economically after a few years of retrenchment. So it's a fascinating moment in Chinese history. So I'm trying to get that written at the moment. But people can find me on Twitter. I'm at JM Chatwin. And yes, the book is pretty widely available, I hope. So I do encourage people to try and get hold of a copy if they can.
So you can follow me, Nicholas Gordon, on Twitter at NickRIGordon. That's NickRIGordon. You can go to AsianReviewOfBooks.com to find other reviews, essays, interviews, and excerpts. Follow on Facebook or on Twitter at Book Reviews Asia. That's reviews plural. And you can find countless other author interviews at the New Books Network at newbooksnetwork.com. We hope you subscribe if you're listening to the Asian Review Books podcast now on all your favorite podcast apps, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher. Rate us, recommend us, and share us with your friends if you want to support us continuing to interview those writing in, around, and about Asia. Next week, join us for an interview with Raza Mir, author of Murder at the Mushaira. But before then, thank you, Jonathan, for joining me today.
Thanks for having me.